And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. The field situation on the Gaza Strip after the repeated violations by the occupation of the ceasefire. The ongoing debate inside the entity about the guardianship that Trump exercises over Netanyahu and his administration, as well as the draft law to execute Palestinian prisoners in occupation prisons, and the continuous attacks on Lebanon were the main topics discussed by commentators in the Hebrew media. We addressed them in this episode with Ms. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator of Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Hebrew language media paid great attention to reports that the United States might submit a draft resolution to the UN Security Council to form a multinational military force, the majority of which would come from Muslim countries, to manage the situation in the Gaza Strip. An Israeli analyst wondered whether it would be possible to carry out military action against the Gaza Strip in the presence of such a force. What is the truth and the goal behind the United States putting such a draft resolution in front of the Security Council?
We should be very clear that nothing the United States is putting forward has any interest in protecting the rights of the Palestinian people or really truly even restraining the Zionist project, except to the extent that it becomes inconvenient for the goals of U.S. imperialism. In essence, this is just a reboot of what was previously called the France-Saudi so-called International Stabilization Force, which is actually meant to impose internationalized occupation and colonization on Palestine in order to protect the interests of the Zionist regime rather than to protect the interests of the Palestinian people against genocide. It should be differentiated from attempts, for example, by the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, to call for a Uniting for Peace resolution that would require non-complicit countries to be involved in protecting the Palestinian people, which means the United States, the country that provided the tens of billions of dollars in weaponry to bomb Gaza, cannot be a part of nor directing such a force. The goal is not to impose stabilization and protection for Palestinians, but instead to provide a mechanism to actually carry out the wishes of the occupation.
Okay, so, but if they are not, as you're explaining, they're not the protector of the Palestinians, then why put such a draft in front of a Security Council?
Well, because this draft is aimed to internationalize the occupation. It's meant to serve Israeli interests so that they don't have to sacrifice.
But they're not happy about it.
Well, they clearly are. They're actually pretty convinced that they'll be able to get the United States to agree to what they want. And there's no reason not to, since the United States is the provider of all of Israel's weaponry in the first place. So there's no break in the relationship between the United States and the Zionists. Just because the Zionists are demanding more constantly doesn't mean this is why you don't see them actually yelling and screaming about it and having objections to it, because they actually view it as tools that can be used, just like they would kidnap Palestinians and send them as essentially human shields to protect their soldiers. They would much rather be able to send Muslim international soldiers to attack the resistance so that they don't have to sacrifice the lives of Israeli soldiers instead.
Okay, but they don't even want Turkey to be involved, and that's a dispute between Israel and Americans.
Well, they don't want, this is true, they don't want Turkey to be involved because the Zionists want to be the sole major power in the region that is subordinate to the United States as the main imperialist hegemon.
But how is Turkey a threat?
It's not necessarily that Turkey is a threat, but it is an alternative, especially it's a NATO member and it has strong cooperation with the United States and it has strong economic interests. And so the Zionists are actually kind of concerned about the possibility of being replaced or being equal to the other kind of allies of the United States in the region. They don't want to be equal to them. They want to be above.
Okay, but in your opinion, what task does America want the proposed international force, in your own opinion, what do they want them to perform exactly?
Exactly what the Zionist guy said they want them to perform. That is to prevent Palestinian sovereignty and self-determination on any of the land of Palestine, including in Gaza, to replace Palestinian security forces, which have been the only security forces that have actually protected the Palestinian people, to impose a safe space for the mercenary forces like those of Yasser Abu Shabab, Hussam al-Astal, and these other kind of gangs that the Zionists have attempted to set up as collaborators instead, and to essentially launch military attacks on the Palestinian resistance under the cover of Muslim international soldiers rather than under the cover of the
Okay,
Zionists.
Do you think that the countries that accepted to be part of this draft resolution, will they take the mission that the Israelis and the Americans want, such as disarming Hamas? We're speaking about Azerbaijan, we're speaking about the Emirates.
Well, certainly the Emirates will. They've been funding the collaborator gangs that are, they've been funding and arming the collaborator gangs that are currently trying to carry out the Zionist mission, and they've been pushing and demanding the normalization of every country.
But will they do
region.
It publicly, Charlotte?
They're doing it publicly right now. There is the Emirate, the UAE government, and its official position, and I'm not talking about the position of people, is 100% in the Zionist camp, even more so than some Zionists. So, yeah, of course they will. There's no reason to believe they wouldn't. Now, the individual soldiers that are sent, perhaps they will have a conscience. But, of course, the Emirati army is not actually, is often not comprised of Emiratis, but is the Emirati military presence is typically basically through the use of mercenaries and contract soldiers.
Yes, and one of the major concerns to the Israelis, according to this report, is the freedom to carry out military operation if such a draft resolution went into action and these countries are inside.
Essentially, the United States just wants the ability to sign off on the Zionist military action, nothing more, nothing less.
Okay. One of the commentators in Hebrew media said that the Israelis must start collecting prices in the Gaza Strip to compensate for what they pay through the Gaza agreement managed by the Americans. Could the Israelis actually shift the yellow line and take other similar steps, Charles, even if the Trump administration is totally against it?
The Trump administration is not totally against it, and I think we should be really clear about that. The Trump administration is not a mediator. They're not in the middle. They do not want the Zionists to do things that are inconvenient for the United States and its broader imperialist interests in the region. However, they, if the U.S. was against it, they would stop providing them with billions of dollars in weaponry. Any mere verbal disagreements is actually meant to push the U.S. to openly state how much they are open to giving the Israelis permission to do anything that they want. There's no other purpose for this. It is political theater and not reflective of any kind of actual dispute between the Zionists and the Trump administration.
But so, with all these billions that you're speaking about when it comes to weaponry, but still, as you are seeing in these videos, the Israelis are not satisfied. And here, actually, they're saying they want compensations after this war that was managed by the Americans.
I mean, the Zionist entity constantly demands more, but that doesn't mean that it's not receiving full support already. For example, the Zionists, especially the extreme far-right Zionists, etc., you see that they are constantly complaining about and denouncing the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, despite the fact that the Palestinian Authority is going out dismantling explosive devices created by the resistance and arresting and imprisoning hundreds of people in the resistance in the West Bank in order to provide security for the Zionist regime.
So could the Israelis shift to the yellow line and take other similar steps?
Well, if they, I mean, they're violating the ceasefire on a daily basis. There have been over 200 martyrs since the ceasefire went into effect due to Zionist violations. So on a daily basis, they are violating the ceasefire. However, there are consequences to their violating the ceasefire. It's just that those consequences aren't going to come from the Trump administration. They're going to come from the people of the world. They're going to come from other countries imposing sanctions on them. They're going to come from, first and foremost, the Palestinian people who have never given up their resistance nor their right to resist. And so it's not going to be the Americans that impose those consequences.
Meanwhile, one of the Knesset committees approved the draft law to execute Palestinian prisoners in occupation prisons. This topic sparked reactions within the entity, and some believe that the path toward approval of the law is now open and that it will become a legal reality. Why has this bill put forward now?
Well, there's a few reasons. One is that Ben-Gvir and his party are actually campaigning for their future by demonstrating their commitment to human cruelty. So when Ben-Gvir was doing a video to promote this bill, this execution of Palestinian prisoners bill, he was filming it in front of Palestinian prisoners thrown on the ground, shackled and chained, in order to show some kind of dominance, when the fact is that those Palestinian men have more dignity and honor in their little finger than any of Ben-Gvir or any of the members of the Knesset. It's very clear that they were trying to impose this form of humiliation and psychological warfare against the Palestinian prisoners. We saw Palestinians liberated in the recent prisoner exchange come home and say that the Zionists would actually bombard them with videos of destruction and genocide in Gaza and tell them that all of their family members had been killed in an attempt to break their will. But more importantly than that, the fact is that there is already a policy of execution and assassination of Palestinian prisoners inside the Zionist prisons. There have been 81 martyrs since 2023 inside the Zionist prisons, most recently Mohammed Gawadra, just 3 days ago. And in addition, this does not count the hundreds of Palestinian bodies that have recently been returned to the Gaza Strip, all of which are shown to be tortured, handcuffed,
and shot. Feel the threat of opening such a file about the Palestinian prisoners behind bars? And that's why he wants things to be legal and he wants to take it the formal way.
I think to a certain extent this is true. It's also an attempt to kind of cover up or to erase the reality of what's already been happening by saying, oh, this isn't something that should happen in the future, when the fact is that in the first place, it's already happening. And in the second place, this is another place where we're seeing the Zionist far right and extreme right kind of in conflict with slightly more liberal Zionist forces. Not because the liberal Zionist forces want to protect Palestinian lives, but because they are concerned about the effects of provoking an intifada in the West
Bank. So do you think that this draft will be ratified? Or is it likely to face an international opposition?
It is certainly possible that this draft will be ratified regardless of whether there is international opposition, because we've seen time and time again from the Zionists, particularly the extreme fascist trend which is currently controlling
the Zionist state. Yeah, but what about internal opposition also?
There is certainly internal opposition, but right now what we see is that in the Knesset, the Zionist far right has the control of the majority, which is why they're able to keep the government, and why they've been kind of postponing and attempting to delay corruption trials for Netanyahu, etc., in order to prevent the fall of the government and new elections. So there is internal opposition because they're concerned about the effects that this will have on Palestinians in the West Bank and the potential of a new threat of an intifada. But at the same time, it's unclear whether it's going to pass, but it's certainly possible that it does, and it requires really that we not look at the fact that, oh, there's a ceasefire in Gaza, and just ignore the ongoing violations and ignore the ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people, but really escalate this boycott actions, international isolation of the Zionist regime, because this is the real face of Zionism. It's fascism, it's human cruelty, it's destruction of humanity, and they're just trying to kind of legalize the ongoing crimes that they're carrying out on a daily basis.
Okay. Moving on to Lebanon, where Israeli threats to expand the aggression against Lebanon are escalating, especially after Qatar's threats to bomb Beirut, which prompted Hebrew media commentators to pause at the possible scenarios and expectations regarding this issue. Why do you think that the United States would not actually approve the Israeli military striking Beirut, and how could this influence the situation going forward?
Well, of course, every day the Zionists are carrying out assassination attacks, bombings, targeting of construction equipment, targeting of engineers doing rebuilding of homes, attempting to prevent the reconstruction of South Lebanon. And that this is supposed to just pass without comment or notice and not even be considered a ceasefire violation, even though there have been thousands and they take place on a daily basis. The United States is currently trying to redirect the Lebanese government in order to carry out its wishes. It's trying to use financial coercion, economic control, and political domination in order to almost essentially, they want to push the Lebanese government into creating internal tension and even a civil war inside Lebanon. That's what the United States is trying to do. And certainly having the Zionists coming out and bombing the capital of Lebanon quite openly,
that's why they don't want Beirut to be struck.
Essentially, you know, Katz, Netanyahu, etc., they have like a very short-term vision. They are looking at next week only, at their kind of level of control and domination. The United States is taking a little bit more of a long-term view, and they are concerned that if they want to maintain long-term imperial hegemony in the region, if they want to coerce the Lebanese government into accepting their demands to carry out disarmament of the resistance and accepting kind of permanent military subjugation to the Zionist regime, they're certainly not going to be able to do that if the Zionists are openly bombing the country and trying to destroy it. They won't be able to. The U.S. is looking to achieve the long-term goal, while Katz and Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are going for a short-term TV burst that will boost their popularity and get them to win next year's elections in the Knesset.
Okay. Moving on to what the Hebrew media called espionage cases inside the Israeli entity for the benefit of Iran, where an Israeli media outlet revealed a suspect who was arrested accused of being recruited by the Iranians, according to the indictment against him. Do you see a potential attempt here to actually tarnish Iran's image by saying that tourist area was a target and that there were attempts to recruit drug addicts and also members of mafia families?
I mean, there's an ongoing effort to tarnish the Iranian image in Zionist media on an ongoing and daily basis, and in order to essentially gin up enthusiasm within among the Zionist public for more war with Iran, which certainly Netanyahu and Katz have expressed their interest in, again, in service of their own narrow political goals rather than the long-term interests of the Zionist regime. Mm-hmm. And so the fact is that Zionist citizens clearly remember the 12 days that just took place. They remember the very effective attacks and responses of the Iranian military, and frankly, most of them don't want to experience that again, and they're actually concerned that an Iranian response would be stronger. So they want to fill the news essentially with constant stories about the Iranian threat in any and all forms that it can take, because there's no other way for them to justify any kind of military attack or any kind of invasion or aggression against Iran, other than by attempting to create this kind of popular sentiment that they hope will enable people to put up with the fact that any aggression against Iran is going to be met with a strong and serious response.
Does that mean that there will be a war against Iran?
It doesn't necessarily. I mean, the fact is that the Zionists themselves are well aware that they used up a large number of their missile deterrent missiles during those 12 days. They're well aware that their own capacities are constantly being overstated and hyped up, but they certainly want to keep a general environment of warmongering among the population.
Ms. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator of Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes.
In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And my guest speakers, as always, Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you, Brother Muhammad Javad.
Thank you very much, the pleasure is all mine. And how about you, Sayyid, how are you today?
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. In this series of programs, actually, you must know that we, get to know some kind of movies and we criticize it. In the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program, for one, actually, as an example, we have chosen the movie The Fountain, which was produced in 2006, directed by Darren Aronofsky, featuring, actually, Hugh Jackman, Rachel Weisz, Cliff Curtis, to just name a few. Well, IMDb gave this movie 7.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes gives it 52%. Metacritic, 51%. And the budget for this movie was around $35 million. The Fountain, this movie, is a science fiction romantic drama. Three people living in a different century embark on a search for the Tree of Life in order to protect their loved ones and receive the gift of immortality. The movie explores the pain of loss, the complexities of relationships, and the human desire to overcome death, showcasing the different approaches to deal with this complicated subject, death. Well, before we move further with the movie and our program, the movie critique program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio, we're going to take a break and then we'll get back and we continue our program, The Viewpoint. Stay with us.
A special tree grows hidden. The Tree of Life. They say whoever drinks of its sap will live forever.
Symbol of your pledge to find the elixir of immortality. You shall wear it when you find Eden. And when you return, I shall be your Eve.
Welcome back to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, helping me criticize the movie The Fountain, produced in 2006, directed by Darren Aronofsky, of course. We've been discussing the critique of this movie from the last two episodes onwards, and would like to continue that in this episode as well. Sayyid Abdullah, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode. What does this movie, The Fountain, imply about the nature of human suffering? This seems to be inherent or experienced by every human being who comes to this world, right?
Yeah. When it comes to suffering, obviously with this movie specifically, that they show you that no matter what happens, or no matter what you do need to accept that pain and suffering is part of life and you need to live with it. You can't avoid it. In order for human growth, even from an Islamic perspective, mind you, the key to growth is through problems and troubles and tribulations and suffering.
Yes.
You will not grow when you have life laid out easy for you. Mm-hmm. No one does.
Yes.
So your learning process, your emotional process, everything works on pain, basically. Yes. We work on pain. Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, He makes that very clear. He said He created life and death just to trial you. So in trial, mainly is through death. And even the Quran says we will trial you with death. We'll trial you with less money. Mm-hmm. We'll trial you with less food. And we'll see. Mm-hmm. So through pain, we grow. And this movie, I think they also focused on that. Mm-hmm. That no matter how hard he tries to bring it to life or bring that memory, it just doesn't work anymore. You just need to grow with it. Accept it, grow with it. And this is the reality of life itself.
Isn't it fatalistic?
Fatalistic?
Yes.
In what sense?
Like in the sense that whatever you do, it doesn't matter. That fate, faced with,
no.
It's going to come.
No, see, the idea is not, we're not trying to fight faith or fate itself. We're not trying to fight fate. Fate is going to take its course regardless.
Yes.
But what you do in the process matters.
Mm-hmm.
So death is inevitable. At some point, I'm going to get a phone call that says your father died, your mother died, your brother died. There's no doubt about that if I live before longer than them. I'm going to get that phone call. That's fate.
Mm-hmm.
It's just decided. Death is decided.
Yes.
But how am I going to deal with it? Makes a difference.
Exactly.
To Allah makes a difference. To people around you makes a difference. To even the dead makes a difference.
Yes.
So, for example, when we discuss the other movie, you see that you need what you do, how you cope with it, makes a huge difference to even the people who leave that world. Because on the other side, they will be looking at you like, okay, we're crossed over. We're okay. We're happy. Why are you killing yourself over this? It's just a matter of time before you come to us. So just accept it and go with it.
Exactly.
So that matters. Your action matters.
Mm.
Fate itself will take its course regardless.
I see. Okay. It's actually what the lesson is matters, you know, what it counts.
Exactly.
At the
end. Exactly.
Okay. Thank you very much. Brother Yasser, how are the relationships in this movie, The Fountain, used to explore themes of love and loss?
So it's an added point to what Zahid said.
Yes.
And it just came to my mind when you were speaking, the concept of a tree.
Appreciate it.
And you, because the movie is all about the tree.
Yes.
And normally we find that the strongest tree is that tree that has and has survived in the toughest of circumstances. It lasts longer.
Mm.
For example, a tree that lives in the desert with no water survives longer.
Yes.
So is that going through the pain, going through the suffering, going through the difficulties makes you stronger.
Mm.
So that's another point if you want to put the tree into the symbolism that comes, that can also be pointing there.
Thank you.
Your question on loss and so on. And
love
so,
and loss, yes.
So for example, again, there's a relationship here in the beginning where there's a relationship between the scientists and the animals.
Mm-hmm.
There's one relationship
and
all the scientists and the animals. Yes. And then obviously the main thing of the scientist and his wife. And then other characters, that there was another lady there. I can't, the head researcher, I can't remember her name, whoever she was. She was also like the relationship between him, like the overseer of that relationship. Most of those people, especially when it came even to the animal, you could see that they were ready to accept it.
Mm.
But he wasn't.
Yes.
So therefore, even then, from the, even the acceptance of losing the animal, that particular, I think it was a chimpanzee, led him to the research of the tree.
Yes.
In order to help his wife. But then when he lost his wife, he kind of lost it.
Yeah, flipped
out. But then he found acceptance through her book. The book that she wrote and he read it, he kind of saw that, no, she must be in a better place or there must be something beyond this and so on and so forth. And we can see that in most of these movies, whether or not the director knows it or not, it shows certain innate feelings within the human being.
Mm.
What happens after death? Again, as you mentioned, eternity, immortality.
Yeah. These are fundamental questions.
Yeah. So, and
existential questions.
Of course, that's the thing. It has bogged mankind forever.
Yeah.
And mankind has not been able to, by themselves, come with answers. And the reason that they find themselves in a rut is because they've rejected those particular individuals who have been sent by Allah or by God in order to give them the answers to these questions that have bogged them down.
Yes.
And this is a problem that we have. If you remove yourself from those individuals, i.e. the Anbiya, therefore you're not going to get questions by yourself.
Yes.
And the questions you may come up with may be obviously satanic in nature or may completely deviate you and others.
Yes.
Because you've left that divine path that has been placed for you and given to you as a path.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoints, the Movie Critique Program on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
How's she doing?
She had a seizure.
It's been progress at work.
My conquistador, always conquering.
We tested the substance.
There's hope.
Your wife needs you.
Because there's a disease, and there's a cure, and I will find it.
Welcome back to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Said Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie The Fountain, produced in 2006, directed by Darren Aronofsky. Said Abdullah, how does this movie, The Fountain, challenge or reinforce traditional ideas of religion and spirituality? Is it against spirituality and religion? Do you find this movie, in fact, in a stark opposition to religion?
Actually, look, the the idea of the movie itself is taken from religion.
Right.
Right. So the fountain of youth, the fountain of life, the tree of life, the tree of knowledge. These are simple symbols you find within the religious texts.
Yeah, in the Holy Bible.
Yeah, whether it's in the Bible or even in the Quran, for example. So these are texts taken from there. Right?
Yes.
So it's actually dealing with religious concepts, but they're just trying to give it their own idea of it.
Mm-hmm.
And even, for example, when we talk about reincarnation and coming back to life in a different form, that's also religion.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, the whole concept of the movie, actually, it's religious in its nature. Even like a brother said, even if the director does not realize it, right?
Yes.
So it's all in its nature, the spiritual ascension, I don't know, going from one place to another, from one realm to another. How did you know all this information?
Yes.
Based on what did you form this information? Isn't it based on texts? Now, obviously not word for word, but at least you stemmed something from these textbooks, which is the divine textbooks,
yes,
and you created your own narrative and your own script,
yes,
based on these. So rather than actually colliding with it, actually goes hand in hand with it, but obviously with their own version of things.
But I'm pretty much sure that the director or the playwright of this movie was kind of aware of these things or notions, because
they are.
They couldn't have come to such movies.
Exactly, that's the point I'm trying to make here. At the end of the day, they took it from these origins,
yes,
but they gave it their own, ingredients.
Yeah,
so they put their colors and their flavors on it, and they gave us what we have here.
Thank you very much, Brother Yasser. What philosophical insights does this movie, The Fountain, offer?
So one of the main things is obviously life after death, death itself, what
yes
is the philosophy of death.
Yes.
Mortality
versus immortality.
For example, the concept of that, you know, disease, pain, suffering, all of these things are a part of life. You're going to have to deal with it.
Mm.
You know, there's a very beautiful saying by Amir al-Mu'mineen. Someone says, you know, makes a dua, makes a supplication that, oh
yes,
God, do not give me pain and suffering.
Uh-huh.
Says, do not make that dua, because that's one that will never be accepted.
Yes.
Because this world is full of pain and suffering. He says, rather make this dua. He says,
yes,
oh Allah, do not give me, oh God, do not give me a trial or tribulation that I cannot pass.
Mm.
That's a different one. That's a more important thing, because trials and tribulations and suffering is part of the physical world. It's going to happen. And all of this comes in together and culminates in death.
Yes.
And most importantly, knowledge of what happens after death. And it's something that this movie tries to show to a certain level.
Mm.
Or, for example, one of the issues and maybe the main point of the movie is when the person goes and he eats the sap from that particular tree.
Yes.
And becomes that bush,
grass,
right? That bush, right?
Yeah, the bush.
Is that do not think that what you assume to be knowledge of what it means,
yes,
of eternal life,
mm-hmm,
is the same thing that you perceive. It may be something completely different.
Exactly.
I mean, we spoke about this maybe outside of the show. There's a new movie by the same title.
Mm.
The same thing happens. That
I
do
see.
Not expect that water, whatever you want to call it, is what you expect it to be. It may become something completely different.
Yes. Thank you very much, Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. This movie was produced in 2006, directed by Darren Aronofsky, The Fountain. Of course, we haven't finished the critique of this movie, and hopefully we'll do that in the upcoming episode. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our bodies are prisons for our souls. All flesh decays, ash, and thus death frees every soul.
Together we will live forever.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Whether it's through public transportation or a personal vehicle, getting around is a key part of everyday life all over the world. But ever wonder how cars are made? It's not just the carriage itself that gets you around. All the components in a car are what team up to make mobility possible. Starter units, gearboxes, cylinders, and so much more are simply parts of a car that are produced by original equipment manufacturers, or OEMs. Also, OEMs play a large role in Iranian auto industries.
Oh, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. Today, we will venture through Iran's automotive industry and explore its markets. We will take an exclusive look at the production market for vital car parts. We also want to see how they all come together to build one of Iran's top manufacturing industries. So, buckle your seatbelts and let's get this show on the road.
Visited an original equipment manufacturer located in the capital city, Tehran. Iskra Auto and Electric Company of Iran was first established in the early 1990s. The company mainly manufactures alternators and car starters. Its main customers are domestic automakers such as Renault Pars, Saipar, and Iran Khodro. It also has operating licenses in the field of assembling all kinds of vital car engine components. In a sense, this manufacturer is composed of five production units. It has an aluminium die casting unit, where it manufactures aluminium parts with 300 and 500 ton injection machines. Also, its vast mold shop builds and repairs molds and spare parts of machines. Equally important is the machining unit, which is equipped with CNC machines to form the die-casted parts. It has a unit for press and plating, complete with a plastic injection area. And last but not least, the company has a very large assembly hall. Each unit has an average footprint of 5,000 square meters. Many machines that are used in various production stages at this company can be locally manufactured and purchased.
It's not surprising that many industrial machines for manufacturing can be locally made. Indeed, Iran is rich with natural resources such as steel, iron and copper, which are all used to make technology. But Iran also has a lot of talented people, and its knowledge-based companies thrive on well-developed sciences and research in the country.
This manufacturer also designs and builds its own brand of alternators and engine starters, which is no easy task. It uses Iranian aptitudes, science of mechanical engineering, and the wealth of knowledge existing in the country to its advantage. This manufacturer was one of the first knowledge-based companies to indigenize design and production of its products. Around 90% of its starters and alternators are domestic productions. This manufacturer produces thousands of its products each year. It is a major supplier to automotive companies across Iran. This company also works with international brands, and so it has maintained the same high quality standards throughout its products. The quality of its products are proven through successfully receiving international ISO standardization certificates. But that's not all. It also has permits and certificates from Iran's Bureau of Standards, as well as the National Accreditation Center of Iran. And it has received praise for its quality and management from Iran's Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade.
There is a lot of competition in the global automotive industry. Each year, automakers put out new models in the market in order to stay relevant in the competition. But what really drives this industry is quality, dependability, and higher technology incorporated into new cars. A lot of research and development is necessary for this to happen.
This manufacturer also invested a lot of money and resources in its research and development department. Here, it has two laboratories that are fully equipped with the latest technology for quality control, as well as product development. Market pressures in parts production mean there's no room for failure. Companies usually need to rapidly adapt volume and customizations. This is mainly because of the changing needs of consumers. Typically, customers demand the lowest cost per part with world-class quality. This company also exports a portion of its products to Russia. Its future vision is to export its starters and alternators to neighboring countries and find other markets around the world. Additionally, among its future goals, this company plans to make other car parts, such as components for electric cars, among many other items. While this manufacturer has enjoyed many successes in its domain, it has also faced numerous challenges along the way.
Here are some statistics about Iran's automotive parts industry. First of all, this business is split into two segments: original equipment manufacturers and aftermarket parts manufacturers. This last category produces replacement parts for vehicles. Around 70% of the domestic demand for auto parts is locally produced, and there is somewhere around 1,200 automotive parts manufacturers active nationwide.
Iran's Automotive Parts Manufacturing Association estimates that the total annual sales value for auto parts to be around $8 billion. Figures show around $6.5 billion of this value belongs to OEMs. Also, aftermarket component sales generate around $1.5 billion each year. The total value of Iranian automotive parts market was estimated to be worth around $13 billion last year. This is while Iran still imports a portion of its auto parts. Somewhere around $5.2 billion worth of these items were imported in 2019. But Iran also exports car parts to other countries as well. Based on figures from Iran's Automotive Parts Manufacturing Association, nearly $200 million worth of goods were exported in 2019. Major export destinations were Russia and Iraq, among 39 other countries.
The government has outlined plans to increase car productions to 3 million units in the next 4 years. Also, 1 million units of this production are designated for exports. To encourage domestic productions, the government introduced a strategy that would increase local car parts content to 50%. This means that local manufacturers will have to step up production.
The strategy was implemented in 2017 in support of local car parts manufacturers. In this policy, cars made in joint ventures with foreign companies had to be made with 50% local content. Presently, the industry is capable of manufacturing around 1.6 million cars annually. Last year, Iran produced over 1 million units of various cars. This means that car production in Iran went up by 19% when compared to the last 2 years. The industry has created over 700,000 jobs directly and millions more indirectly. Iran's auto industry employs 10% of the country's total workforce and also represents 10% of its GDP. It is the second largest industry after oil and gas.
All right, it's time for me to pull over for a second here because my good friend and colleague is about to take you on an exclusive adventure. Omid, buddy, where have you taken the crew this time?
They have medicinal properties. They soothe skin irritation, protect cells from damage, heal cuts, enhance mood, relieve headaches, treat symptoms of arthritis, and you name it. They are also widely used in the cosmetic and personal care industry. They are famous for their flavor and aroma. In this week's feature program, we are going to delve into the herbal oil and water industry in Iran. Thanks to the country's geographical location and climate, Iran is home to over 800 species of plants that are known to have medicinal properties and remarkable health benefits. Here's a short list of most famous flowers that can be processed into floral oils and waters. Chicory, mint, orange flower, willow flower, and the queen of flowers, rose. Kashan, which is a county in Isfahan province, is the largest producer of essential oils and floral waters in the country. And that is why we decided to visit a company there to see how these products are made. The production, regardless of the type of flower that is used, can be best summarized as distillation. It is the process of separating the components from a liquid mixture by using selective boiling and condensation. Let's take rose water, which is locally known as gulab, and rose oil, for example. Roses, actually the most fragrant type of the flower known as Mohammadi or Damask rose, are harvested in mid-June in Kashan. And then,
once Damask rose petals are picked, they are taken to the facility where rose water is made. The whole process can be summarized into one word, distillation. First, a ton of rose petals will be put inside a steel distillation pot, and then depending on the quality of rose petals, between 1,000 to 3,000 liters of water will be added. The mix is then heated indirectly via steam. This process should be steady so that the liquid content doesn't flow over the pot and only steam gets out. What happens next is that inside tube or cylinder, there is some pipes which carry cool water, which act as a coolant and condensates the steam. The steam that is now condensated is sent down to another container.
The distillation of flowers and herbs has a deep history in Iran. Today, essential oil and herbal water production is not limited to family farms and small copper pots. Large companies have entered the market and dominated the field. Essential oils are extremely valuable because of their high concentration. Rose oil, or queen of oils, is highly sought after for its aroma and powerful topical and emotional benefits. The blooming floral aroma is comforting, and rose oil used topically helps promote healthy-looking skin. There is something special about the oil produced in Iran that makes it unique in the world. Today, people have become increasingly more aware of the importance of organic products. As a result, the demand for drinks made from floral waters has been on the rise. These drinks are extremely refreshing and full of health benefits.
Well, I can see great potential in this business because the production process requires nothing but a distillation pot and some machinery and a staff to do the packaging. I'm sure this business is a profitable one. Anyway, the products that are made in this company are not limited to rose water or rose oil, but they also include some other herbal distillates or floral waters, if you wish, such as orange blossom water or mint water, to just name a few. They also make a wide variety of different drinks with these waters. I'm holding in my hand one such drink, and I'm going to have a sip at it. But Samson Seas, my good friend, don't worry, man. I'm going to bring back some for you, and I'm sure you're going to love them. Back to you, Samson.
Oh, you are too kind passing over souvenirs like that. It's even changed the bottle a little bit. And with that, we have reached the finish line for today. Like I always say, we love hearing from you, so stay in touch. I have been Samson Seas. I'll see you in the next bazaar.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán, recitadas por el señor Baghefi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزع